It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Kirk O'Bear will be back with us next week. And of course, the story that everyone is talking about is this unfortunate stabbing of a young girl by these, or alleged stabbing, I should say, by a couple of 12-year-old girls in the Milwaukee area. The young girl, the last report that I had was she was up and she was apparently walking. So it looks like she's recovering, and thank God she is recovering. This whole situation, and if you're just joining us and if you haven't heard about this, there was a debate about this Slender Man, basically a fictional character, where they're saying that these two 12-year-old girls were trying to please a fictional character. In order to please that fictional character, they had to attempt to kill or kill another girl. And unfortunately, these girls are in middle school. They are 12 years old. The story has swept the country because of just the, I think, the bizarre nature of it and the fact that we have two 12-year-olds who are now charged with first-degree attempted homicide in adult court in Waukesha County. And this is all happening in Wisconsin, and again, it's making news around the world. Now, they're looking into a lot of things in terms of why would these 12-year-old girls do this? Was it because of the internet? Was it because of this website that they looked at, this apparently ghoulish website that depicted this Slender Man? And by some people's token, was a very dark website. And some are even calling it a satanic website, while the defenders of the website are saying this is just fictional. And nobody should take this seriously. This is really no different than a horror movie or something like that. And people who take it seriously, we're not encouraging that in any way. That's what the website says. So they're also looking at the parents, and they're asking questions about these parents. There were pictures all over the place. And even according to some newspapers in Great Britain, I found pictures of these parents that they had published, at least of the father of one of the girls. And the father they depict as sort of another dark person who, you know, likes dark music and all kinds of things like that. And people are looking for answers because that's what people want whenever we have a situation like this, such a tragic situation like this, really on all fronts. But the big question that's being asked is, should these girls be tried as adults in the adult criminal justice system? Or should these girls be tried in the juvenile justice system? If they're tried in the juvenile justice system, then they could be held until they're 25 years old. So that's 13 years. That's quite a few years, but not nearly as long as they would face if they're in the adult justice system. They could face decades and decades in prison. Now, we don't have the death penalty in Wisconsin. And of course, nationwide now, the death penalty is outlawed for juveniles by the U.S. Supreme Court. But we have to ask the question, what are they going to do now? My guess is the attorneys will file what's called a reverse waiver petition, essentially asking the judge to waive them back into juvenile court. Because in Wisconsin, if you are 10 years of age or older, and you've been charged with either first-degree intentional homicide, attempted first-degree intentional homicide, first-degree reckless homicide, or second-degree intentional homicide, then you are automatically in the adult criminal justice system unless the court finds, the judge finds, that if convicted, the child could not receive adequate treatment in the criminal justice system, and transferring jurisdiction to the juvenile court would not depreciate the seriousness of the offense, and retaining jurisdiction is not necessary to deter the child or other children from committing the offense of which the child is accused. In other words, in order to make these girls go back into the juvenile justice system, the child, by her attorneys, have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, it's on them to prove that the child can't receive adequate treatment in the criminal justice system. And you know what? In our criminal justice system, we have many things and many people that are trying to do good things. We have noble people in the criminal justice system that are trying to do things that are revolutionary, that are trying to make our communities safer, that really have our best interests at heart. But one of the things we don't have is, we really don't have, in my opinion, adequate funding in the adult criminal justice system to give these girls what they need. And I'm not saying give them a pass. I'm not saying any of that. I'm not saying that they're not responsible for their actions. What I'm saying is our society better served by locking these girls up for 40 or 50 or 60 years? Or is our society better served by keeping them in the juvenile justice system, still keeping them what amounts to being locked up in a facility, in a juvenile facility, until they're 25 years old, and having them have treatment and programs and things like that that will help them once again be, hopefully, contributing members of society? And would this depreciate the seriousness of the offense to have these girls who are alleged to have killed, or attempted to kill, I should say, this other little girl by stabbing because they apparently believe that this fictional character wanted them to do so? Would that serve the public to have them in the adult juvenile or in the adult justice system? And would it encourage other people, other 12-year-olds, to think that it's okay to engage in the same type of behavior? I happen to be a person who thinks that it would not encourage other people. Because A, these types of situations with 12-year-olds are very rare, and that's one of the reasons why this story is making such national and international headlines. And B, I don't think that another 12-year-old who's going to commit this type of offense that happens very rarely is going to look at this situation and say, you know what, I'm not going to do that because I could be tried as an adult. It seems to me, without having any knowledge about this case and simply by reading the newspaper and reading the criminal complaint and seeing what's going on, that these girls have some pretty serious needs, whether that be mental health needs, whether that be treatment, whether that be something else, because something went awry, very awry, in their lives if this is true. This doesn't happen without that. When you think about your 12-year-old and a person who's in middle school, think back when you were in middle school. Think about your kids when they were in middle school. This type of thing doesn't happen often. And so I think, unfortunately, in our society today, we have so many situations where we treat kids as adults and adults as children. I mean, there's lots of different situations. We trust, if you are in the military and you can go and fight and die for your country at 18, we allow you to do that. Yet we don't allow somebody to drink until they're 21 because we say they're not ready yet. They're not ready to drink yet. But yet we can have a 10-year-old tried as an adult and face almost their entire lives in prison as a result of it, or perhaps their entire lives in prison, depending upon how long they live. We treat them as adults. So we have sort of a mixed bag, and where does it stop? Researchers have found, and medical experts have found, that children's brains are not fully developed. And this is really common sense. It's not like we need medical expertise to know this, but we do have this medical expertise. It says that children's brains really are not fully developed. And quite frankly, oftentimes they're not fully developed by the time that they're 18. But yet we have two 12-year-olds who are charged with this. And it goes without saying that what happened here was horrendous and reprehensible if it's true. But the question of how to react to it and the question of what to do about it as a society is also a complex one. It's easy to say this is such a horrendous crime that we ought to have these 12-year-old girls tried in the adult criminal justice system. That's an easy thing to say. A much more complicated thing and a much more complicated analysis is this the right thing to do? Is society going to be better off if we do that? Is this going to deter others from committing the same type of offense? And I think we need to look at this on a case-by-case basis, and that's what we're doing. But they're starting off in the adult justice system. On in other crimes between 10 and 16, you start off in the juvenile justice system, but there's what's called a discretionary waiver, meaning that if you commit other types of crimes, you can be waived into adult court from juvenile court. And that's anywhere from the lowest of 10 years old up to 16 years old. And there's certain findings on that. So as we react to the gruesomeness of this incident and the horrendousness of this incident, I think we have to keep in mind that what is good for society? Should we lock these girls up for the rest of their lives? Should we have them in the juvenile justice system where they can perhaps make the, you know, make themselves better people and still serve a substantial amount of time incarcerated? The interesting thing about it is that we as a country in the United States lock up more people per capita than any other country on earth. We imprison 25% of the world's population, the world's prison population, the entire world's prison population. We have 25% of it right here in the United States. The United States is a wonderful, wonderful country with many wonderful people in it. But if we fail to examine our system, and if we say that our system is perfect and then it doesn't need any reflection, then we've stopped progressing and we've stopped asking questions. And if you stop asking questions, bad things can happen and bad results can happen. So we will follow this story, this tragic story, and we'll, I'm sure we will cover it more on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm Casey Hoff. We'll be back in just a moment.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Keep your mouth shut. Keep your mouth shut. You too licky-licky. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your mouth shut. You too licky-licky. You better keep your mouth shut. You better keep your eyes open wide. Mind what you do, mind what you say, look into your life.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. And Sheriff David Clark has again caused some controversy in Milwaukee County because this time he issued a press release where he is telling Milwaukee District Attorney, Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm, that he should suspend he should suspend plea bargaining for what he calls serious crimes, that he should stop these deferred prosecution agreements for those offenses, that he should stop deferred conviction agreements for those offenses. And basically what these are ways to plea bargain. He's essentially what he's calling for, what amounts to a ban on plea bargaining, and saying if you have a charge that comes up, you ought not be able to plea bargain it, at least if it's one of these serious crimes, and that either there should be a trial, or the person should just plead to the charge, but there could be no bargaining as a result of that. And I gather from the gist of his argument is that he says Milwaukee County is unsafe, and he believes that it's because there are judges and prosecutors who are making these offers to criminal defendants, and it's allowing them to be, quote-unquote, soft on crime, in his words. Unfortunately, his statements are misguided for a number of reasons. First of all, as the Milwaukee County District Attorney of that office, John Chisholm, as he states quite eloquently in a letter, to suspend the use of deferred prosecutions and plea negotiations and those types of things would essentially be to make us less safe. Because plea negotiations are part and parcel of criminal cases. They happen frequently, and there could be many reasons for it. The prosecutor may have overcharged the case with a too serious of a charge, and they realize as the evidence comes forward that perhaps in order to get the case over with, they should plea bargain. Or somebody, the defendant, chooses to plead to a charge because he or she is worried about going to trial and risking a conviction. There are all kinds of reasons as to why this can occur. And actually, plea bargaining saves endless amounts of money for the state of Wisconsin, because our court systems are already overburdened and overworked as it is. We have too few public defenders and too few prosecutors. We have not enough judges, in my view. And the caseload is so overwhelming that to suspend plea negotiations for these types of cases would be to effectively shut down the criminal justice system in Wisconsin. And what it would also do, by requiring more police officers to come to court and testify at trials, many of which are a week long, it can be longer, and to take those police officers off the streets, what are you going to replace the police officers with? And are you then going to complain when the crime rate goes up? Are you then going to complain that you don't have enough resources? This whole idea, again, it's just so easy to say this. No more plea bargaining for these serious cases because we ought to lock these people up and throw away the key and that's the end of it. Well, first of all, they aren't plea bargaining in terms of offering what's called a deferred conviction agreement in homicides and cases like that. What's happening in many cases, and I'll just give you an example. Let's say somebody gets caught with marijuana, and they get caught distributing marijuana or selling marijuana. Nobody's arguing that's a good thing. Nobody's saying it's right. We know that there's a law prohibiting that from happening in Wisconsin. But then if we're talking about not plea bargaining in those types of cases, what does that do? Does that mean that we're going to then throw people who have committed or they committed those types of offenses in prison and pay $30,000 a year out of taxpayer money to support that and build dozens of new prisons throughout the state of Wisconsin, multi-million dollar prisons to house more people, to pay for them, to give them three meals a day, and to be responsible for their welfare and safety, versus, let's say, a first-time pot dealer who gets caught, and he or she then gets what we call a deferred prosecution or deferred conviction agreement and agrees to abide by certain conditions and agrees to essentially be under a contract, maintaining sobriety, maintaining good behavior for a certain period of time. And if they do that, then they get a benefit at the end and they're still working, they're still paying taxes, they're still contributing to society, and they have this conviction hanging over their heads that if they don't do this, if they don't abide by these conditions, they will be convicted of it. In my mind, that is a much better way to go in many cases. I'm not saying all cases. You have to look at each case on an individual basis. But in many cases, because it saves people money, it saves the taxpayers money, it doesn't lock people up. And studies have found that in terms of rehabilitation, you know, I would say 90% or more, and I'm just throwing that figure out there, but just based on my experience, of people in the criminal justice system have some type of drug or alcohol dependence or substance abuse issue. And so if we can head that off at the pass, if we can prevent that from happening, then we have less crime, we have safer communities, and we have a lower tax burden on citizens. But to just call for this blanket policy of saying no more plea negotiations in these types of serious cases is to deny justice, and it's to deny the district attorney's office from doing what they have a sworn oath to do. And District Attorney Chisholm points that out in this article. He says he has an ethical duty to not do this. And he says that they average approximately 20,000 criminal and child protection cases annually over the last year. An average of 600 to 800 people per year are eligible for early interventions. He goes on to say the suggestion that we suspend all plea negotiations in such cases is legally, ethically, and practically irresponsible. It would lead to the permanent loss of witnesses and evidence. Plea negotiations often allow us to assure the lengthy incapacitation of violent offenders, and the loss of that practice would instead result in these individuals being freed in the community because backed-up court dockets violate defendants' speedy trial rights. You were here in the early 1990s, he's talking to, writing an open letter to Sheriff Clark, when this was a reality. Police budgets on homicide cases alone would be decimated, as we would have to pull detectives and officers off the streets to sit in court for week-long trials, even when the defendant is willing to plead to the charge. Does that make any sense to anybody? No, but it's such an easy headline and such an easy thing to say. And a lot of these tragic shootings in Milwaukee are very complex situations, and it's not about if we just lock up everybody for life, everything's going to be okay. Because we have a constitution. We have defense attorneys. We have prosecutors for a reason. Because we need to ensure that the trials are fair. We need to ensure that the cases are fair. We need to ensure that defendants have a right to due process. And that every case is looked at on an individual basis. But this goes on all the time as people want to pass quote-unquote mandatory minimum sentences, which Kirk and I have talked about many times in this program, that take away judicial discretion. See, I don't even think, from the tone of the press release that Sheriff Clark put off, I can't imagine that he really took a substantial amount of time to think about the consequences of what he was going to say in terms of if that was actually put into place. Because what he was saying, in my mind, is fiscally irresponsible. It's practically irresponsible. And it is dangerous and makes the community less safe. He says, well, if you take them out of the community, then they can't do anything. Prisons keep them behind bars. Well, that's true. That is true. But what happens then? Do you get recidivism? Do you get people repeating their offenses because they haven't had any kind of treatment? They haven't had any kind of rehabilitation? That's what we call them, after all. We call them correctional institutions. We don't call them prisons so much anymore, as some people refer to them, but the correctional institutions. So this type of situation is very, very serious, and it calls for a response that is much more complex than simply saying that this is what we ought to do in this situation. We ought to just lock everybody up and not allow any sort of plea negotiations. District Attorney Chisholm is correct in pointing out the failures of this type of approach and what it might lead to. And if you talk to, I would imagine, most judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys and people who do this every day, day in and day out, who live and breathe the criminal justice system, then I think most of them would honestly say to you that this type of approach is not only harmful to society, but it's also unworkable. And in my view, it's not ethical. So we will talk more about this as we move along. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm Casey Hoff.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff, and I want to talk a little bit about these marijuana laws in the state of Colorado. As we've talked about before, marijuana, at least small amounts for recreational use, were legalized in the state of Colorado. And since that time, there have been people who have said that, okay, this is going to lead to an increase in crime. There were people who basically said that this was going to lead to chaos because more people in Colorado were going to be smoking marijuana, at least so they thought. Well, now we have some results from the Independent Online, which the title is captioned, "Ever since Colorado started getting high, crime has dropped by 10%. Now, that title is a little bit misleading because we don't know if this was a correlation or causation. And in other words, whether the legalization of recreational amounts, use of marijuana in Colorado, at least in small amounts, has led to a drop in crime or not. But what they're saying is it certainly hasn't led to an increase in crime. Crime in Denver, the story says, the capital of Colorado has dropped by 10% since last year, reassuring those who feared that it would rise after the first legal marijuana stores opened in the state on January 1. The statistics published by Denver authorities show that crime overall dropped by 10.6%, while violent crimes, including sexual assault and homicide, fell by about 5% in total. Meanwhile, property crimes, such as motor theft, fell by around 11% in the city as a whole. The article goes on to say, while the fall has not been directly linked to the legalization of marijuana, the trend is likely to bolster pro-cannabis campaigners and those who welcome the $1.9 million in tax the government has so far gathered from legal cannabis sales. When medical marijuana stores are included, the Colorado collected $3.5 million in taxes since it became the first state in the United States to legalize cannabis in 2012, with commercial sales beginning at the start of the year. One person is quoted here, an activist, saying all the naysayers who were just against marijuana legislation are eating crow about now. Colorado's marijuana sales just keep trending up. With the sales of legal weed, they are improving their schools and reducing overall crime rates. Now, there's also a study cited in this that says from the University of Pennsylvania, scientists who claim that marijuana can cause sleeping problems. Okay. Now, so we've talked about this before and said that we were going to follow up on this story because we wanted to know what the effect of marijuana was on Colorado. In other words, was it going to have these detrimental effects that were feared by some, or was it going to be business as usual? And, of course, people who are in support of legislation argue that, well, crime has dropped, and that's as a result of the legislation that was passed. It's hard to say because, quite honestly, you never know if one particular piece of legislation is responsible for the drop in crime. I would say it isn't, but I think we can say, at the very least, that marijuana, at least so far, has not caused any kind of these sky-is-falling scenarios that were predicted by some. And quite frankly, when you talk about marijuana and the use of it in the United States, it's used quite broadly across the United States, even in most states where it's illegal to use. And yet, some call it a gateway drug. Some say that it's something that we shouldn't be sanctioning because it leads to harder and harder drugs. And we could debate about that forever. The bottom line is, right now in the state of Colorado, the marijuana is regulated on the open market, and you have taxes that are coming into the state of Colorado. And certainly those taxes can go to things that can improve the overall situation of Colorado residents. Whether you agree with people smoking marijuana or not is, I suppose it's relevant to this conversation, but people have been doing that now for a long period of time. And most people, when they look at alcohol and they compare alcohol to marijuana, you could certainly argue that alcohol is more detrimental to marijuana, or excuse me, to human health than is marijuana. And I'm not arguing that any of this is good, and I'm certainly not supporting or endorsing people using drugs or alcohol. But I'm merely saying that it's happening, and as long as it's going to happen, is it better that it's regulated out in the open market? Or is it better that we keep it behind closed doors where it's unregulated? The same can be true, can be said for arguments about underage drinking. There are many who believe that back in when underage drinking was, when the drinking age was 18, that things were better then because people often who went to college and who were 18 at the time would abuse that because they've lived, you know, I guess they've lived where they haven't drank alcohol, or many of them, in high school, and then they go to college, and you're unregulated, and you don't have your parents around talking to you all the time, and a lot of these kids get in trouble as a result of it. And many other countries around the world have a drinking age that is lower. So what's the best solution for this? I don't know, but suffice it to say, we at least have some evidence right now that it doesn't seem to be hurting, at least in the crime area in the state of Colorado. There's also New York's high court this week is considering or considered one of the first legal challenges to state and local laws that make it a crime for people to bully others online, especially children. This from the Wall Street Journal. The 2010 Albany County law, one of more than a dozen around the country that criminalizes cyberbullying, pits free speech advocates against a community that has given prosecutors a larger role in affairs that typically had been handled by schools. The court's ruling could set the tone for other state high courts hearing challenges to such laws, as well as for states and localities considering criminal penalties for cyberbullying. Besides Albany, four other New York counties and more than a dozen states, including Louisiana and North Carolina, have similar laws. A wave of states passed cyberbullying laws after the 2006 death of 13-year-old Megan Meyer. She committed suicide after a neighbor pretending to be a teenage boy on MySpace sent her cruel messages. And we all remember, I think, how horrible that situation was. And nobody wants their kids to be bullied. You know, if I'm a parent and I see my kid being bullied, I don't have kids yet, but once I do, I'm not going to like that bully, and that bully is going to make me angry. The question becomes, how do we regulate and criminalize bullying? And is it too vague to do so? Most people will tell you at some point in their lives, they were bullied by somebody. We've all heard about the schoolhouse bully and how that happens. And it's hurtful and it's wrong and it's terrible and it shouldn't be sanctioned. And we need teachers to be able to have the tools to step in and say, no, this is wrong, and to scold the child and have the parents take care of that. But we don't live in a perfect world. And certain people are going to be bullied, and it's going to, in some cases, unfortunately, lead to tragic consequences. The question becomes, should we have the criminal laws step in and brand that bully a criminal as a result? It's difficult because we have a First Amendment in the United States. And while the First Amendment is not unlimited, it certainly does allow for a lot of speech and free speech. And it allows people to say things in most situations that could hurt somebody else's feelings. When does it go over the line? The Albany law makes it a crime to communicate, quote, private, personal, false, or sexual information, end quote, intended to, quote, harass, annoy, threaten, abuse, taunt, intimidate, torment, humiliate, or otherwise inflict significant emotional harm on another person. Now, how exactly do you define that? I mean, there are lots of words in there that are very vague. Harass, annoy. You know, one person's annoying is another person's, you know, tolerable behavior. So how do you draw the line here? And actually, these are criminal penalties. A high school student was the first to be charged under the law after the then 15-year-old created a Facebook page in 2010 and posted photos of other teenagers with captions that included graphic and sexual comments, according to court documents. In one of the posts, the 15-year-old wrote that another 15-year-old girl kisses like a dog, quote unquote. He was arrested in 2011 after police learned his identity through his IP address and charged him as an adult with 8 counts of violating the Albany cyberbullying law. And many of these posts were very disgusting and offensive. But they charged him also with harassment. The 15-year-old boy told police that he intended the pages to be funny. A judge threw out the harassment charges, but not the cyberbullying counts, which carry a punishment of up to 1 year in prison and a fine of up to $1,000. The boy pleaded guilty to a single count of cyberbullying on the condition that he could challenge the law's constitutionality in the higher state courts. He was sentenced to 3 years of probation. The judge ruled that the law was another judge ruled that the law was constitutional as applied to speech directed at minors, but not speech directed at adults. The judge said this is about harming children, and that's what we're identifying with this law, and I hope it stands up in court. So you may know that the First Amendment, there are certain exceptions to First Amendment free speech that the United States Supreme Court has identified, such as true threats and fighting words. And it could take many, many hours to go over exactly what that means, but suffice it to say you could still, in most states, or I think you're supposed to be able to hurt somebody's feelings, even though it's wrong, even though it's bad, and even though we shouldn't sanction that type of behavior, to make it a crime is a big deal. And I think when we go down this path of criminalizing speech, criminalizing bullying-type speech, it can be a very dangerous path that we go down. So we have to be careful about it. You're listening to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. There was a judge who this week was actually caught in a fight. Brevard County Judge John Murphy. This is not a judge from Wisconsin, but elsewhere. Will take a leave of absence and seek anger management counseling following a scuffle in his courtroom Monday morning, officials said. The Chief Judge John Harris issued a written statement afternoon related to an incident and an alleged fight that occurred between the judge and an assistant public defender there. says that Murphy's cases have been reassigned to other judges. What happened in this particular case is that the public defender was standing there in court, and there was a question as to when they were going to schedule his client's trial. And what essentially happened is, of course, as you know, and as you probably know, in the United States, you have a right to a speedy trial. And as a part of that speedy trial, you can make a demand for a speedy trial or waive your right to a speedy trial. Well, this public defender, and this is in the state of Florida, stood up and said that he was not going to waive his right to a speedy trial. And that got the judge to be a little bit upset, although the attorney who was saying it wasn't exactly the most tactful about how he went about it. And it led to a verbal altercation where the judge then challenged this public defender to go outside, essentially to go out and brawl, to go work it out outside of the judicial system. And so they did this, and there's a camera. There's camera footage of this showing this public defender walking to the side of the courtroom, going outside with the judge, and you can hear sort of yelling and screaming in a scuffle. And you can hear some foul language that allegedly came from the judge. And there was apparently a physical altercation. Another person in the story reports that the judge punched the public defender in the head. So this is just an unusual situation. Obviously, in a courtroom, sometimes tensions heat up. Sometimes people get, they lose their cool. But attorneys and judges and prosecutors are supposed to behave in a way that is respectful and deserving of the sanctity of that courtroom. And in this situation, that appears not to have happened clearly. When the judge came back in a weird twist, the people who were sitting in the gallery of the courtroom were clapping, and they were sort of cheering on the situation. It was just an odd thing. So now this judge has taken a leave of absence, and there was a statement that was sent out in that regard. You know, another story that caught my eye, concealed carry is a big deal in Wisconsin, and this from the Daily Union in Jefferson, Wisconsin. A recent day at the Jefferson County Dog Park turned into more than one dog owner bargained for when her firearm accidentally discharged, wounding her. According to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, a female at the Jefferson County Dog Park suffered a self-inflicted gunshot wound when she unintentionally fired her handgun on May 11th. The Jefferson County Corporation Counsel, Phil Restow, said during Monday's meeting of the County Parks Committee that the woman has a Wisconsin concealed carry permit allowing her to legally carry the gun on county park property. She fired the weapon while attempting to tuck it back into her belt. The bullet injured her behind, and she was treated for the wound at an area hospital. No other people or dogs were injured. Jefferson County Sheriff's Office was notified of the incident and has since been investigating what charges might be appropriate. The county is unable to restrict patrons from legally carrying concealed weapons in county parks, of course, if they have a legal concealed carry permit. But discharging those weapons in county parks is illegal. So what are they going to do about this? Are they going to charge her with a crime or not? Person who had a legal concealed carry permit. We will follow that story for you. And Middleton High School, as being my alma mater, a number of Middleton High School students defied a request from school officials not to cross-dress during senior dress-up day. And it could cost one student attendance at graduation. This, according to Channel3000.com, Superintendent Don Johnson said district officials heard and saw on social media on Monday that the seniors were planning on cross-dressing for a senior dress-up day on Wednesday. The dress-up day is a tradition dating back several years. Johnson said school officials made an announcement to students asking them not to cross-dress on Wednesday. Because of its potential hurtfulness, it could cause gay, lesbian, and transgender students in the school. According to Johnson, quote, "The cross-dressing, I don't believe, was ever intended to be discriminatory towards this group, but in effect, it very well may have. And so we asked the seniors to say, let's think about a way to celebrate that will not alienate or really impact in a negative way any of our student body." Now, apparently what happened as a result of this is most students were cooperative when asked about when asked to change their clothing. However, there was one student who could face penalties for being less cooperative, according to the article, which could include not being allowed to attend the graduation ceremony. And this all started because of Facebook. That's another thing that's popping up all over the place now. We are seeing a rise, at least in the criminal justice system, of people, and this isn't a criminal matter, at least not according to this news story, but I'm talking about in the criminal justice system. We see a rise of people who are now using social media, things like Facebook, things like Twitter, all of those types of mediums, YouTube, people posting things on YouTube that you wouldn't believe that they would post. And there are prosecutors and there are defense attorneys, including myself, who look into social media avenues because it can often uncover evidence in a case that can very well help out a case. Some people post things on things, and you have to remember that everything is recorded. You know, we're having this debate about what should happen in terms of the NSA and Edward Snowden and his behavior. Some people calling him a traitor. Some people calling him a whistleblower. You've got people saying different things about Edward Snowden. The bottom line, though, of what Edward Snowden uncovered is that the government, and this is really undisputed, has been collecting millions and millions of phone records of Americans in terms of their metadata, telling where they are, where they've been. You can tell a lot about a person from that data. And so we live in times now where there is surveillance all around us, everywhere you go. When you walk into a grocery store, you're probably being surveilled. When you walk into a convenience store, you're probably being surveilled. Even when you're walking around sometimes in parks and other places like that where you wouldn't expect a camera to be, you're being surveilled. And so on top of that, you've got people posting things on Facebook and other social media about what they're doing at various different types of the day. And I see people who are posting everything about everything in their lives on this social media. And once you post it, somebody is going to see it, and it's there, presumably forever. At least it's captured somewhere. Do you know that there are websites that allow a person to go back and check the internet websites from years and years ago? You can actually do that. There are websites that actually log the internet sites from years ago, even after they've been deleted and they're not current. So you can see what happened. So you have to understand that whenever you're posting something on the internet, it's there and can be there forever. And you have to be very careful about what you post. Not necessarily because you're doing something illegal, but because it could be embarrassing, it could come back to haunt you in some way. And so it's just the latest example of this type of behavior. People now are not really communicating nearly as much verbally as they are electronically. That's how people are communicating now. They're communicating electronically. It was email, and it's still email. And now it's social media, and we're saying where we are. Oftentimes, these types of websites will tell a person where they are, exactly when, at what time they posted something. So you can often tell from what somebody writes on Facebook exactly where they are. And so that can be scary. And on top of that, when you have government officials who are admitting to, in some cases, having secret programs that collect all of this data of Americans' phones, you have to be cognizant of that. And some could argue that it's a good thing that we have more cameras because we can help those who are innocent and convict those who are guilty. And there are others who believe, well, yeah, that's all fine and dandy, but there comes a point where we have too much surveillance and no privacy anymore. And that can be a scary area for people. It's gotten to the point where now, when you're sitting there on a computer, and I'm not even being paranoid about this, this has actually happened, there are certain folks who can actually take your computer camera, the camera that you're looking at when you're typing things into a computer, and turn it on and see you and see what you're doing. Now, I'm not saying this is happening on a mass scale, but I'm saying it has happened to the point where I know people who put tape over their computer camera because they just value their privacy, not because they're doing anything wrong, but they don't want somebody looking in on them and they don't want taking that chance. So this is all something that we can all be aware of as we go forward. You've been listening to Legal Defense. This is another edition of Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a wonderful weekend.